We're back on CH9 Live. Mark Rusinovich finally showed up. We missed a few things, but that's all right. You know, he's busy. We're with Aaron Margosis, who you've met before. We're going to talk about sys internals, but also this is going to be Ask Me Anything. It can be any
kind
of thing.
We can ask you anything?
Not me.
Oh.
No, only the experts get to talk. And then you guys need to tweet questions to Mark. We didn't spend enough time on sys internals in our latest interview.
We haven't. You can never spend enough time.
Let's spend more time.
Let's do that.
So this will be sys internals with your fellow author and expert, Aaron Margosis.
Zoom on that.
You getting a shot on that?
No, they're not.
So right off the bat, what's new?
What's new?
What's
with
latest?
Sys internals?
What's the latest, greatest?
It's always hard to keep track of the latest.
Okay.
But two weeks ago, I released an update to Process Explorer that adds two features I think are kind of interesting.
Okay.
One is a process timeline column. Actually, it adds a few features, but process timeline column.
Uh-huh.
So process monitor's got this tree view, which shows you the lifetime of processes as bars. So you can see, relatively speaking, what started in the more recently than longer in the past.
Okay.
So I've added that to Process Explorer. You can get the same kind of view. The second is auto runs shows you where programs and DLLs are configured to auto start. When you boot the system, when you log in, when you run Explorer, when you run IE. I integrated auto runs, actually, it's code directly into Process Explorer and add it and have a auto start location column and property in the process property. So you can see if a process that's active has been configured to auto start where its auto start location is. So for example, you put something in the startup folder or the run key.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll see in the process tree, if you add the auto start column, that's where it was configured.
Awesome.
Also, Process Explorer a lot of times used for debugging.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at thread stacks to see where things are hung or where threads are spending their time.
Yep.
And the CLR team added the capability for using some CLR debugging APIs so that Process Explorer can look at the stacks of JITted or NGEN'd application, .NET threads.
Nice.
So you can actually now, it can walk the call stack and see symbols for the various functions.
Excellent.
So that's a big one. Then I added this, I can't believe I hadn't thought of it before, but when you look at the process properties, you see the path to the process image.
Okay.
And I added a little explore button so you can click it and go to that folder. So if you want to.
So now let me ask you this. I mean, you're implementing this, so Win32 application.
Yeah.
So you're using C++ and C, your favorite language, by the way.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, so you're still writing code these days.
I mean,
it's good to see. I mean, even as a technical fellow, when you're architecting like information as a service and virtual machines and stuff like that for Azure, you're still actually getting dirty writing code, and that's great. So, Aaron, what have you been up to?
Not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot.
Yeah. No, that's not true.
I didn't think that was true.
I work in Microsoft consulting services. I work primarily with U.S. federal government customers, and they keep me very busy.
I'm sure.
So.
Stuxnet, Flame. Just kidding.
No. I can't actually comment on that.
Yeah. Don't.
Okay. No.
So
I had nothing to do with it.
No, of course not. Now, from the SysInternals book, last time we talked was at
TechReady. Yeah.
And you gave me a signed copy of the Windows SysInternals Administrator's Reference. Have you read it since then?
We haven't.
Have you read it yet?
Cover to cover, man.
Okay.
Quiz him.
No, I haven't.
I don't remember it. I wrote it a long time ago.
I'll just say Process Explorer. I could probably do it, but let's not do that.
Okay.
Hey, ask questions. #CH9 Live. We got Mark Rusinovich, Aaron Margosis, Sys Internals. I like the implementation details because we never talk about that.
Yeah.
And so with Process Explorer, tell me how did one of the new features you just added, how did you implement the new feature? How did you implement the click on the button and explore the process map? How'd you do it? How does it work?
To click on the button and jump to the folder?
Yeah.
That I called shell execute.
No. Don't jump to the folder, the more complex one.
What? Like which one?
So you mentioned that I could click on a button and explore, not in a folder, but it sounded to me like it was a map.
No. So the process timeline, I think maybe.
Okay.
There's the process timeline, the .NET stacks.
Yes.
And the jump to a folder.
Yeah, not the jump to a folder.
Location.
Yeah.
The auto start location was the more complex one
to
integrate. Auto runs has probably 12 different modules. I've kind of modularized the code so that different modules responsible for looking at a different category of auto starts.
Okay.
Everyone, there's 15 different variants of ways things configure to auto start, or more than that, really. That's 100 ways to configure things to auto start somehow in Windows.
Hmm.
So the code, though, is written with the structure of auto runs in mind.
Okay.
And Process Explorer has a very different architecture to it. What I needed to do was go and integrate the two so that auto start locations could be enumerated, which can take a while, especially if you've got something like a network share, reference to a network share in an auto start location.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a poor network connectivity where the thing takes 30 seconds, 60 seconds to resolve or time out. So I can't have the main Process Explorer view stalled during auto start enumeration. So the enumeration is actually kicked off in a separate thread
That
then goes and calls into auto runs directly. A few tweaks to auto runs to get it to return information with a call back into Process Explorer's code so that Process Explorer builds up a data structure of image name, so user profile, image name, auto start location.
Okay.
And when it gets a notification from auto runs, that thread sends a message into the main Process Explorer windowing thread to say new auto start location. Then causes it to look at the tree to see if we've got that process with that image listed,
okay.
And if so, update it so that it's data. So we've got the auto start location information for it,
or
DLL if you're in the DLL view also shows auto start locations for DLLs as well.
Now when we talked at Tech Ready, you showed it. We showed a demo of the GPU. This internal tools looking at what's going on for the GPU at any given time.
Yeah,
which is actually quite useful these days of GPU. It's not that general purpose, but
right.
That's the name of it. How's that going? How's that evolving?
So I haven't really made any changes to that other than I think tweaking some of the terminology to be more clear.
Okay.
It's actually the APIs that I'm using are undocumented APIs coming from the DirectX engine.
Ah.
So I work with the developers and the DirectX team to get surface out that information.
Fair enough.
One of the problems, though, is that there's a couple problems with the way the APIs work and how I show them in Process Explorer. One of them is that the DirectX engine knows about engines, GPU engines, but it doesn't really understand what their purpose is. Only the video drivers from the manufacturer really knows GPU engine 0 or node 0 is my 2D acceleration engine.
Okay.
Engine 1 is my 3D acceleration engine. Engine 3 does texture transformations.
Okay.
So Process Explorer gets this raw information, and I use a heuristic to figure out which one is actually the one people are most generally interested in, which is the 3D acceleration.
Yes.
And I show that one by default, though I let you override it if the heuristic is wrong and pick which engine you want Process Explorer to show you. So that was one challenge with surfacing that information. Another one is that there's different types of GPU memory. There's memory that's on the card itself, and there's memory that's allocated for the GPU in RAM. That's used by the DirectX stack. And both of those are potentially places where you can run into out of resources. Or the application's using so much GPU RAM in RAM as for double buffering and for doing transformations in RAM, then you can run into resource problems, right, and performance problems. But each one of those has names internally that don't really map to names that people understand, and so it's actually extremely confusing. I have a long thread with the DirectX guys saying, okay, dedicated GPU memory, what exactly is that? System GPU memory, what exactly is that?
They're like, oh no, it's another mail from Mark, man.
Yeah, so
you're a hacker, you're a Jedi hacker. It's good, you figured that out.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I want to, Aaron, come on, I want you to speak a little bit about something.
Aaron's very shy.
He is. I noticed that
very
the last
retiring,
time we did an interview. He's
very
senior statesman is really
what
he's like.
That's how he communicates with because the aliens really run everything, and so you guys just don't look at each other and talk, right?
Well, he works
that's how it runs.
He works in the deep dark recesses of the government, so
I'm sure.
Yeah.
He's used to not saying much in public.
Okay, so
let's talk about
Sys Internals.
Yeah, so another thing I'm doing with Sys Internals is I'm continuing to present at events like TechEd, that's
excellent.
What I'm doing here. One of my sessions is a SysInternals talk. This is the third year that I've done a SysInternals primer. And the idea behind the SysInternals primer is, you know, there's Mark sessions where he talks about, here's troubleshooting using the tools. And he shows a few facets of the tools to solve a problem. And it's a lot about the problem. What I do with the SysInternals primer is a bit more like the book, which is describe, here's a bunch of stuff you can do with the tool. And we don't put a story around it. We just show a lot of features of the tool. Mm-hmm. So the first year we did, you know, the three big ones, I think, would be Process Explorer, Process Monitor, PS Exec. The second year was auto runs, disk to VHD, access check, two others. And this year, we were like, okay, what are we going to do next? Because, you know, we could go back and do Process Explorer again, but no. We came up with the idea of doing SysInternals gems, which is deep dive.
Yeah.
What's that?
They're all gems.
Hidden nuggets, hidden gems.
Hidden gems.
Right. So
okay.
We're diving a little deeper and showing some advanced things you can do with some of the tools, as well as looking at some of the tools that are the least downloaded, the least known tools.
Yes.
And demonstrating things you can do with
yeah,
that.
Tell him what happened at TechEd US. He was doing the session.
Okay.
And he mentions a tool called FindLinks, right, which is very obscure tool that I wrote a few years ago.
Fairly.
And he asked the audience, several hundred people, is anybody aware of this tool, FindLinks? Anybody even know what it is? And there's no hands that go up, except for one.
Okay.
And so Aaron looks over, and it's me.
Which I was shocked. I was absolutely
shocked. He didn't know I was in the room either.
Mark only comes to my sessions when he's really afraid I'm going to screw up real bad. So I took that as an interesting sign. So.
But this is really interesting. So number one, what does FindLinks do? I best I can hazard a guess, but I'm
go
not
for
going
it.
To.
Go for
so
it.
So FindLinks, what does FindLinks do? And what are some other gems? I like where this rabbit hole is a good one.
Yeah. Okay.
So what is FindLinks?
What do you think it does?
I would say that
you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's what he said. It's a file system tool. It looks for hard links that link two different or more than two or more files to. Content on a disk can be found under several different names when you have files that are hard linked together. So, if the content itself is reference counted. So you can have it pointed to from one location, like WinSXS, some subfolder, as well as from System32.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, a great example of one that you should go look at with FindLinks is notepad.exe, which actually is, you can find it in Windows directory, there's a notepad.exe. Mm-hmm. In the Windows System32 directory, there's a notepad.exe. Mm-hmm. But there's other places where it's also located.
Really?
But it's all the same file. It's the same content, just different links to it.
So they're like shortcuts.
By having that,
they're not really shortcuts.
They're not really shortcuts. They are content and then multiple pointers
to it from file directories. Names.
Okay.
So file directories. They're
but
multiple
entries.
But you said that they're
not actually a file.
Well, notepad.exe is a file.
Yes, of course it is.
And then directories can have a
and
a
it
name
looks
for the
like
file.
It's in the file, in the directory, but it's a pointer to.
Yeah, well, it's really in all of the directories at once.
But it only takes up space one time. Yeah. So you can have 50 apparent copies of this thing scattered around, but it's only taking. If it's a.
That's what you should actually do for demoing that.
I do.
What do you do?
I demo that.
Notepad? No, you can make lots of copies. Make a file, make hard links too.
I do. You were there.
I wasn't paying attention.
He was doing email by that
point.
Nice. I had lost him.
Okay, that's great. It's great that you do that.
No, we have a question.
You did a good job too.
Twitter, but I do want to. Can we please continue down the rabbit hole of what are some of the less known but actually useful? Of course, you think they're all useful.
Yeah.
But which are
otherwise I wouldn't have written them.
Exactly. So let's talk about some really interesting ones that may be kind of edge cases, but very useful. But I want to get to an important person's question, and that is, what are the top three uses for SysInternals?
Top three uses.
Writing a book about it.
That's one use for
them. That's one.
That's one use. Make some money by writing a book.
Rich and famous like Aaron got off the book.
Okay.
Actually, the number one is troubleshooting, which is why I do the Casey Then Explain talk.
Yes.
Because I've kind of established that as my traditional tech ed, tech ready closing talk, because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and I just people like seeing the war stories that other people have encountered with Windows and Windows applications, and so I show how they solved those problems.
Okay.
Using the tool, mostly the tools.
That's the number one reason for the SysInternals tools.
Yeah.
Troubleshooting.
Number two?
Number two.
Digging into the system and learning about it.
Yeah.
Learning.
Just learning about what's going on under the covers.
And actually that's very useful in the context of developers.
Sure.
So there's lots of development teams at Microsoft that make heavy use of the tools to analyze the performance of their software, to understand why it's not working properly.
Yes.
It's kind of a form of troubleshooting, but more learning.
Yeah.
How things work. And I'd say third use for the tools, might be malware analysis. It's heavily used for malware analysis as well. And so I'm doing a session tomorrow on using the tools.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you did that at Tech Ed North America.
Did it at Tech Ed North America.
Now let me ask you a question. I mean, has anyone hacked SysInternals?
What do you mean by hack SysInternals?
I don't know. They figure out a vulnerability. You forgot to, maybe you made a little mistake in your coding.
What?
Yeah. And they're like, hey, if you run Process Explorer with like this command,
no.
I can inject this function at this location and take over your machine.
I don't have any bugs like that.
Fair enough. So more hidden.
Actually, but what's?
But yeah.
Speaking of hacking,
he just set a challenge out there.
Great.
Go ahead.
Now the reason that I asked you about what you meant by hacking is that their malware community, they have traditionally for a long time now blocked security software. So disabling antivirus, obviously one of the most common threats.
Yes.
But what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years more frequently is malware that blocks the SysInternals tools too. Explicitly, that's coded into them, like if I see Process Explorer, kill it.
Interesting.
Or stop it from executing. In fact, I'm kind of proud of this in a bizarre way, that Flame, which is considered by many as a successor to Stuxnet, also created by the U.S. government and Israel to go after Iran's nuclear program, reportedly, allegedly. But Flame blocks the SysInternals tools.
It does.
Yeah.
And so you're telling me easy?
Put another side to it, though, because there's another side to the malware issue, and that is that malware will sometimes use SysInternals tools. They'll bundle SysInternals tools. And so when I go to customer sites and I try to download the SysInternal suite, it gets blocked because it contains PSExec and PSKill.
Mm.
And those are apparently, at least
some
of the firewalls will block that
lots
stuff.
Lots of malware to spread for the malware to spread across the network.
So how do you feel about that, Mark? I mean, how does that make you feel, Mark? So it's your evil brother that we talked about in the past. He's taking your stuff and he's injecting it into malware.
Yeah.
He's like, great job, Mark.
But
the thing is that you can do the same thing with built-in Windows tools as well, right? So there's stuff that's right in there. CMD.exe gets used by malware all the time.
We should block
TFTP,
it.
FTP.
We should block CMD.exe.
We should. Actually, a lot of places do by policy. It's really frustrating to work in those environments.
But speaking of malware and SysInternals, I think the most ironic for me is you probably heard of scareware, which is fake anti-malware that takes your system hostage either by making it so you cannot dismiss it or it actually hides your files until you pay.
I haven't heard the term scareware.
Yeah, that's the term. Very common. Actually, it's been around. Scareware has been around since early 2000s, but last few years we've seen a growth in scareware variants. And what scareware does, that it's kind of a community where you can license the scareware engine and then put your own user interface on top. So you'll see the same scareware engine with a bunch of different kind of brand names on it. And one of them that became popular about 2 years ago was SysInternals Antivirus.
Crazy, man. All right, we got two questions. First one from Tourism Geek. Has there ever been an issue so far that Mark couldn't sort out with SysInternals tools? Excellent question.
Has there ever been an issue? There was one time.
One time?
Yeah.
And what was it?
I can't remember. It was a long time ago.
I can't remember. His 1040.
Yeah.
Actually, I like the second question as well. Debug View support WinRT or even Windows Phone 8 as a remote machine for debug string?
Actually, I worked with so Debug View wouldn't capture debug output coming out from a WinRT app due to ACLing on the debug output buffers. So the Windows RT team told me about it because that some of them wanted to use this debug view. So I fixed debug view to work, and I can't remember if I released that update or not. A lot of times I have updates queued so that I can spread them out, and you know, if I go, if I'm a bit too busy over a few months, I can still release a queued up update to make keep the site kind of fresh and going. So I can't remember if I've released that update to debug view that works with...
That would be cool.
Do you remember?
It would be good.
So yeah.
You should.
I'll do it soon.
Support modern developers, man. Modern development. Yeah. Modern engineers, right?
That's right.
We want to use the same tools. I mean, if you're building an app, and apparently a Win32 application is not an app, but if you're building an app that runs in a sandbox, you should be able to use these great tools because you are going to run into performance issues. You are going to run into threading issues, hanging issues. Aggressive asynchrony in Windows RT requires you to, you know, the debuggers need to be really good. Speaking of which, you're now in the cloud world, and we're all living in the cloud world. And I ask you this question every time I talk to you. You always give me the same answer. It's the one I don't want to hear.
Oh, why?
And that is sysinternals tools for cloud computing.
Yeah.
Now you could say, well, Charles, they're a virtual machine running, being hosted in this fabric, whatever. But that's not really what I'm asking, so I'm going to try to get it right this time. The type of computing that goes on in the cloud world, so you have two kernel systems.
Yeah.
You have all these virtual meshes of virtual machines interacting maybe in some sort of virtual network or whatever. There's potential for your tools to be pointed in that direction to help me understand more about what I don't understand, which is why I would use your tools anyway.
Yeah.
So can you talk about how cloud computing, if at all, might be helping to a new tool, shape an old tool, refactor a tool?
So there is, and I do have ideas for sysinternals-like tools for the cloud. The problem is that it's a lot easier and less time-consuming for me to iterate on the existing tools than to start a brand new tool, especially one that's as complex as one that would work across multiple machines would be, which is what I'd have to be doing here.
Yes.
So I haven't had the time to sit down and do it.
Okay. Well, you're too busy, man. Yeah. I mean, come on. Take a sabbatical and do that.
Yeah.
And write a couple more books. So, Aaron, you won't tell us what you do for the government?
He's got four out now. You want to talk about your books? Well, you've almost got four.
Yeah.
Just very, very recently.
Almost got five, actually.
Really?
Well, if you consider part two of that.
Right. That's true. Yeah. So he's got this one.
Yes.
Which we talked about. Here, talk about that one.
That's Windows 7, right?
This is Windows 7 and Server 2002.
Nice.
Part one. Part two is done.
It is?
In the can.
Okay.
Just, it's... now going through the publishing machine to come out the other end, hopefully in about a month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got Zero Day, the novel I've been
Trojan
on your show
Horse.
For,
yeah.
and Trojan Horse, which is coming out, which I gave you a copy of.
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
It.
I've been reading through it.
Yeah. I didn't get a copy.
Yeah, he forced
I actually
me.
Said, give me a copy of that book, man.
Yeah.
With a, like a, no.
Yeah.
Like you,
I couldn't say I couldn't.
Mark
resist
would
him.
Take me, man.
So
you take my.
I asked, and that's not the way to go about it. I guess.
No, you'd be nice. Hey, Mark,
you
can
just
I have
told
that?
Him.
I gave you an electronic copy, didn't I?
No.
Oh, you never asked.
Tweet questions to Pound CH9 Live, and if you're in the live audience and have a question, yell it. But, you know, what can I tell you? Tweet. What was I asking you before you interrupted?
Asking about what I do. For the government.
Yeah, what do you do for the government? And there was also the question around, and you sort of answered, you don't have time to do the cool cloud tools.
Yeah.
The Windows internals, to me, is interesting, but I want to get back to Aaron. Just for the government, you got there's a lot of interesting things going on with what we read in the news and stuff, and without going into those details, like what kind of stuff do you do? I mean, you consult them on...
It's a variety of stuff. I do a variety of niche stuff that I guess nobody else wants to do. I get stuck doing...
The garbage man.
The garbage man. The cleaner.
They do,
wow.
I guess.
Interesting.
Starting now, anyway, I guess they'll call
so
me
call
that.
Him the garbage man.
The garbage man, all right.
Mark said, therefore. So I do a lot of stuff regarding application compatibility, helping them migrate to Windows 7, helping them migrate to running a standard user. Mm. I do a lot of stuff around security configuration and... you know, locking down the systems to avoid problems and make it cheaper to run the systems.
Yeah.
I do some various programming type work, various types.
And all of this involves heavy utilization of sysinternals tools.
Quite often.
You find
absolutely. Quite often. That comes up a lot.
because I got into the sysinternals tools because my work took me there. I do a lot of Windows internals type work and understanding what's going on in the system. And so that's actually part of why I ended up co-authoring the book with Mark.
Excellent. Yeah. So we have another question from Hood, who's been asking a lot today. Could be another one that's not going to get answered, but any plan for a new edition of Windows internals that covers Windows 8, which does have a different kernel than Windows 7?
Yeah.
And Windows RT, which is, I don't know what to make of, I mean, that's interesting, very interesting. That's Windows RT for ARM only.
Yeah.
And then Windows Phone 8, or even Xbox. Do Xbox devs use your, I mean, they must use your tools.
Actually, I don't know. I mean, they've got a different
operating
thing
system
going on over there altogether.
Understood. We're not going to get into that at this point. But can you, I mean, when are you going to write your next Windows internal book?
So I haven't sat down to think about when I do a Windows 8 book.
Okay.
There's a few issues that make it not look like it's going to be anytime soon. One is I'm so busy with other things in the cloud.
Sure.
The other is it's Windows 8 was, if you look at the amount of change going from Windows Vista to Windows 7, there was a decent amount of change, but it wasn't huge. I mean, I think we expanded the book by about 250 pages.
Yeah, you broke it into two parts, too.
So. Okay.
But if you look at going from Windows 7 to Windows 8, incredible amount of change all over the place. And so it's going to be a pretty big task to rev the book.
Absolutely. Right on. So take your time. And, we don't really want you to know what's going on anyway, man. So, okay. So are we going to get more control over Azure VMs? Direct VM connection using VM Connect, snapshots, etc.
So, I'm not sure how to interpret that question. I'm not sure what control means. When it comes to snapshotting a VM, you can snapshot the disks. You can't snapshot the VM state, like with Hyper-V's kind of memory snapshots.
Okay.
And I don't see us ever supporting that. It's not. We're not focused on that kind of scenario right now.
Okay.
Which is really snapshotting a VM in the sense of a snapshot tree is kind of dev test.
I wonder if they're asking, might there be a way to run the Hyper-V manager on my machine and access and control something in the cloud?
That's definitely not going to happen.
Okay.
And snapshotting, probably not going to happen for a long time if it happens at all.
Okay.
It's that kind of snapshotting. Snapshotting the disks of a VM for backup, for example, to get consistent snapshots, that's something that we're definitely going to do.
Okay.
Today, you can use blob storage APIs to snapshot a disk that's in use by a VM, but it's not a consistent snapshot in the sense that it doesn't leverage volume shadow copy inside of the VM the way that backup software would normally integrate with VM for backing them up.
Sure.
So that's going to come in the future.
Oh, these are hard problems.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of VMs, can you talk a little bit about the new VM world? I mean, you've done talks on it both here and in North America, Windows Azure Virtual Machines. One of the questions I had around that was how many virtual machines one could have and still be performant. What would be a crazy thing? Like, how many virtual machines can run in a real piece of hardware?
Well,
how about that question?
Well, it depends on the hardware, of course. We've got different types of hardware in Azure data centers.
Okay.
So, like, some of our systems have 8 cores, some have more than 8 cores.
Okay.
You buy a VM based on a certain VM size menu. The largest VM we currently sell is 14 gig of RAM and 8 cores.
Okay.
So, right now, that's the largest we can support on any single machine, but that's going to change soon.
It's pretty big.
In terms of the number that you can create, I mean, really you shouldn't care if it's on a machine by itself or not, because performance isolation will make sure that you get approximately the same performance, whether it's on shared hardware or you happen to land on a system by yourself. But in terms of the number that you can create, the default subscription core count when you sign up for Azure is 20 cores.
Okay.
So if you created extra small VMs, which are a quarter of a core, count as a quarter of a core in terms of the licensing.
Okay.
Actually, I think that counts as one core in terms of against that quota. But so you could create 20 VMs by default. If you want more than that, simply call up, say you want more, and they'll unlock you a lot more cores.
Awesome.
After they understand what you're trying to do.
So I had Jeffrey Snover on the panel that you missed today, Mark.
The best speaker at TechEd.
He's great.
He's awesome.
And you guys would have been great to have you dice on some things because the Windows Server 2012 seems to be, to me, an amazing piece of engineering.
Yeah.
The new file system, the new storage management, the new, I mean, it's amazing. Storage spaces, blah, blah, blah. And I made me kind of think Windows Azure runs, Windows Azure itself is powered by Windows Server 2008 R2, which used to be Red Dog.
Yeah.
So if it was Windows Server 2012, not really talking about hypotheticals, just curious, you'd have the new file system, the new storage kind of world. You must be really interested in what those guys have done.
We're adopting it right now. We've got a plan to integrate that into the infrastructure. As far as those features, though, they're aimed at a different kind of cloud environment than what we've built.
Okay.
So we don't need a storage spaces, for example. We got Windows Azure Storage.
Good point.
So there's a bunch of features that we will take advantage of, and some that are ones that don't make sense for us.
But there is the one where you can have a SQL Server on a file server that actually scales.
A SQL Server and a file server that
you can host SQL Server on a file server machine that's typically used for file server, and it scales and it's fast.
Oh, well,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, all right. So questions from better people asking questions. Do you plan to make Azure IPv6 ready?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that one's like...
Yeah, great. Yeah. Is Core System the official name of MinWin and Windows 8?
I don't think there's an official name, and it's not a
product name or anything. Yeah. So,
guess there's a component called Core System, which is larger than MinWin. I've talked about that before.
You have?
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily remember it.
Yeah.
So you have MinWin, which was the experiment to see how far you could whittle Windows down. Somehow turned into a Mary Jo Foley thing.
Yeah.
Then there's Core.
Which is larger than MinWin.
Like Server Core, for example. I know it's
Server
different.
Server Core is even way
bigger.
Larger.
Yeah. Got it.
And Core System, the difference is Core System is engineered from a dependency perspective, so there's no dangling dependencies coming out of it. It's self-contained. Okay. Whereas Server Core is just ripped stuff out and you've got something that's left. Mm-hmm. Where there's you call the wrong API and you fall off the edge.
All right. So, any thought on the challenges posed by SPD kernel mode rootkits, malware that does not rely on the kernel and is autonomous?
It's always challenging. I mean, there's I just read a nice technical analysis of a bootkit, which is something that infects the MBR and launches itself into memory as Windows is booting, disables patch guard. You know, creates a hidden partition with its own kind of pseudo file system.
Oh, man.
So that kind of stuff's very hard to find, first of all, and then clean off.
Absolutely. And what, I mean, basically, they own your machine.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't even know it.
That's
it goes
right.
back to, and we talked about that on the security panel that you missed today, where we, I'm just playing around.
Yeah.
So this is the one where we sort of talked about, you know, how really super skilled hackers. The bad hackers, the Sith hackers, not the Jedi hackers. Hacker, unfortunately, is a word that's been abused.
Yeah.
It's not a bad word. We all hack.
Yeah, so supposedly, you know, the cracker was supposed to be the bad word.
Cracker would be better, because you're trying to, you're trying to crack your enemy's secret codes, are you doing something bad?
It's all perspective, right?
Exactly.
Was Stuxnet bad? We talked about
this.
We
did. We had an interesting conversation about that. I don't know. I'm not going to, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know there's some really super smart people behind Stuxnet who are capable of building exactly what he's talking about. Say your evil twin, where you could do terrible things and never be found.
That's right.
That scares me to the nth degree.
Stuxnet, I think if you look at the evidence, right? When did it come out and when did Zero Day come out?
You know,
there's one man on the planet.
Yeah, let's get down. Let's find out right now.
One man
live,
on the planet
live.
Who's smart enough to have authored Stuxnet, and he did it to promote his novel.
Did you author Stuxnet, Mark? I'm going to ask you point blank.
I cannot comment.
Did you author Flame?
No.
Did you have anything to do with the Hey, Richard Hine, how you doing, Richard? What's the Cloud NGen environment? It's actually Cloud JIT. What's the Cloud NGen environment I've heard rumors
cloud.
Of?
Well, I don't know what that is.
So essentially, we announced at Windows Phone 8 launch, I think this was announced.
This is where you can submit your app and it will engine it for you so that.
Yeah, well, actually, it's jitting.
So
It's not engenning. Well, Ngen is going away. So okay. The
concept's the same.
Concept's the same.
Yeah. Takes you basically compile it and
blah blah blah.
So now it's in native form
and in
so
a cloud.
So there's better performance when you yeah.
So it's a cloud JIT. That's the rumor that you heard of.
Yeah.
Larry Law.
I heard of that rumor.
Light bulb.
How do you secure your stuff?
How do you secure your stuff?
Very carefully, I guess.
No, I mean, honestly, have you been when's the last time you had malware in your machine?
2006.
2006?
No, 2005.
You
2005,
sure?
Yeah. No, actually, so 2005, that was the Sony rootkit, which I got infected with.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That you then wrote about.
Yeah, and, then I wrote about it.
So Sony's still on your, they send you Christmas cards and stuff?
Every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Mark.
We're
better because of you. I get
right
that.
On.
Yeah.
Right on.
But, yeah, my daughter, though, you know, one day she's like, I walk into her room, and I find out that, I can't remember how it came out, but she hasn't been using her computer because the internet's broken on it. So I go look at it, and it's because she got some crapware on it that killed the internet. So I actually fixed it for her, but then I took the computer away. So,
aww.
No, I'm just kidding.
She's running as admin, right? Like, I mean,
she is running as admin.
To, yeah.
She's running as protected admin.
Protected admin.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
All right, so we got more questions in. This is from Diz71.
What's the difference between protected admin and admin?
Nothing.
Nothing. Exactly.
Zero.
Exactly. So I've had
good job.
No malware in my house.
You sure about that?
He started locking people down. Like he did.
How do you know you don't have a rootkit that runs?
The only thing they can use is the browser.
No, I run Apple. They're immune. No. Kidding. Obviously kidding, self-evidently kidding.
Sure? There's always a kernel of truth in every joke.
I won't allow any Apple software in the house. That's part of it.
Yeah.
So everyone runs latest version, patched version of Windows. Nobody has an admin account except me. And no Java and no Apple stuff on the.
But you don't use your admin account. You use a standard user account. Only for administrative tasks do you switch, correct? Aha.
Yes.
So,
we call them.
Do as I say.
But I don't do anything on the computer, so, you know.
Does standard user really protect you, though?
Yes.
There's obviously things running in admin context on your machine.
It used to be. So, my father's machine got hacked by some malware back in 2002. He was running Windows 98 at the time. I flattened the machine, installed Windows XP, divided it between an admin account and a standard user account, and used fast user switching to switch between them. He never had a problem again. So for years, running as standard user pretty much meant that any malware that tried to run on your machine was going to fail. That's not true anymore. So malware regularly assumes standard user rights. It puts itself in...
In fact, Stuxnet did.
Tell us how you did that.
Stuxnet?
No.
Oh, because it used an elevation of privilege exploit. Right. Okay. He can talk about the details of how he wrote. He can show you the source code.
4 0-day exploits, right?
Four.
4 0-day exploits.
I never asked anybody what they were. Should we do that?
Sure.
All right.
One. Do you want to talk about them?
So I'm not done talking about the admin accounts.
Okay, the admin accounts.
And why he runs his admin all the time.
We have to hear the story again, man?
No, that's okay. We're done. Let's move on. There's some more questions.
Here. Actually, so why does standard user protect you? I mean, so you can still get infected. Protect is an interesting term in this context of malware. For example, if I get infected as a standard user, which you can just as easily as an admin, and the malware steals all my bank account information, I'm not protected any more than if I'd been an admin. What it will protect you from is the malware establishing a persistent presence that can't be cleaned off the machine by anti-malware or by somebody with administrative access.
So
that's the key difference. But other than that, it's equivalent from the impact it can have on you.
Personally.
Yeah.
Right. So my mother-in-law's computer got attacked not that long ago, within the last year or two. And so the malware ran in her standard user account. She logged in. She couldn't use the computer. It took over the screen and said, you know, you're infected, you need to pay.
Scareware.
It was scareware, exactly, that somehow had gotten onto her system. So she logs onto her standard user account, can't do anything, right? It will not let her run anything. So I go over there,
I log out of her standard user account. I log into the admin account, which is completely unaffected by the malware because it couldn't jump from the standard user to take over the whole system. From there, it was really easy to use auto runs to see the auto start entry points that the malware was using in her account, her standard user account, and to remove it. So when malware gains admin rights, it can be impossible to clean.
Yeah, when malware has admin rights, you're on a living play. It's on a living level playing field with you.
Okay.
There's no. It's once it's on your turf that way, it gets much more difficult to get it off. You know, deal with it.
Sure.
Like we were talking
about. Subvert the operating system itself. Whereas if it's running a standard user, it can't.
It runs under the kernel.
Yeah.
It runs in boot.
Yeah.
I mean that's crazy. And totally doable. If you think about how many shareware apps you can install and go yes when it says you want to give this one the ability to actually run as an admin right now.
Yeah.
All right, so we have more questions from humans. MSDTC wasn't supported in earlier versions of Azure, especially because you could not enable it on SQL Azure. Any change?
Not right now.
Okay. Mark was learning WPF when he wrote some Azure internals tools. Will he do it in Metros? I want to ask him. And he's right here.
Yeah.
Mark, are you going to do...
So the tool he's referring to, I was making a Storage Explorer tool.
Yep.
And WPF. You know, one of the challenges, when you're making a cloud tool, you want reach with the cloud tool. And in fact, you see the way that the Azure platform itself is trying to make itself more accessible. Like the portal has gone from being Silverlight to HTML5. So I'm in this dilemma when it comes to client-side tools for the cloud. What should I write them in? WPF?
C++.
Native. And in fact, I do want to write some in C++. Most likely, that'll be the one that I pick. Mm-hmm. And that'll make it easier to port to Metro, even. The problem is that I'm waiting for Scott's team, Scott Guthrie, to create C++ wrappers for the Azure REST APIs. So I don't want to have to go do like...
Casablanca is your friend.
Who?
Casablanca.
Yeah.
Casablanca is
a... No, it's actually, I've looked at it. It's very incomplete, though.
It's very incomplete, yeah.
It doesn't do the things that I would want it to do.
Of course not.
Do, so.
It's not that advanced yet. Is there a native way to replicate on-premises VMs to Azure VMs for DR? That's IT pro speak.
Disaster recovery.
Okay. Is there a native way? I assume that means like some off-the-shelf tool that you could buy to do it. There's none that I know of, but it's very simple to write one. Again, taking Casablanca to use the storage APIs and take VM snapshots and then copy them up to blobs.
Awesome. Yeah, so we need to get the pedal on the metal on C++ support on Azure.
Yeah.
Got all the .NET in the world.
Scott said yesterday that's the next language he's going to focus on. So.
Excellent. So tweet questions to #CH9 Live. We have Mark Rusinovich, Aaron Margosis, and you never finished the at least two more tools that you think are very useful.
Two more tools.
That no one knows about.
Yeah. Give me a sec. Talk
about we have to look
else.
It up.
Yeah. I don't remember.
There's so many.
Yeah.
Do you?
I use SigCheck a lot.
SigCheck?
Yeah. I use that to see, first of all, is it signed or is there something wrong with the signature? To verify, is this from who it claims to be from?
Okay.
It hasn't been modified.
It also shows file version information.
Information as well as the manifest. So you can tell, is this thing marked to run as admin or highest available or as invoker? So I use that fairly often.
Cool.
Access check, I use it more and more, although I did cover that in the SysInternals primer last year. Streams, whenever I download anything from the internet, I use streams to remove the alternate data stream so that it's unblocked. Simulates clicking the unblock button in Windows Explorer.
Interesting.
Yep. I will cover that in the talk on Friday. Zoomit I use
Zoomit.
The time. And
Zoomit,
I don't know.
All the time.
I've seen more people using Zoomit lately, which is good.
Microsoft presenters are required to use Zoomit.
Excellent. They don't. Where do you hear they're required?
That's because you don't read the emails from the track owners telling everybody, please use Zoomit in your presentations. So it's a good thing you do anyway.
Yeah. Otherwise, I'd be violating the policy.
Yes. That makes them think that you're reading their emails.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't I've ever talked about that in a session. Maybe I'll do that someday.
That's a big one.
Logon sessions. Logon sessions enumerates LSA sessions on the computer. And that can be useful for identifying, are there lingering sessions that are available to have
token
hashes and tokens compromised by an attacker? And what is authenticated on the machine right now? So I'd probably use it more just for informational purposes than to troubleshoot. But
you can keep talking.
I'm looking for
tomorrow Friday. I'm going to include stuff about DU, which is used for discovering how much usage, how much the disk is being used.
Okay.
It takes into account alternate data streams, and hard links, and things like that, which Windows Explorer and the dir command don't do.
Okay.
Core info shows you your CPU topology and characteristics.
Okay.
So it'll show you the size of your caches, the NUMA nodes,
nice.
The processor groups. It'll show you processor features that are present. So this is actually useful for understanding whether your system can support Hyper-V on Windows 8, which requires virtualization type features that are only sometimes available.
Okay.
I did a talk today in which I showed VMMAP. I was talking about data execution prevention, and to describe it, I used VMMAP to show the virtual memory of Windows Explorer and how the different pages are marked differently depending on whether it's image, which is mostly read and execute, as opposed to the stack, which is read and write. Because if you have write and execute in the same memory space, then you're at risk for being compromised.
Excellent, man.
RAMMAP. So question is, what's consuming my physical memory?
Yes.
RAMMAP will show you exactly what it is.
Cool. So we got a question from Hood again. Mark said he will talk to the Taskman developer. Taskman, to clarify some memory concepts, does TM and Win8 show memory info accurately now?
Yes. In fact, the rule is if you see a problem or deficiency with Windows 7, it's fixed in Windows 8.
Rock and roll, man.
Yeah, everything.
So how's the Taskman doing?
Taskman?
Yeah.
It's Metro now, so it's awesome.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Rock and roll. So we still have we still have the exact amount of time left. We have 9 minutes, 10 minutes. Ask some questions. Mark's here. Mark, what else is going on in... I want to ask this now. You mentioned one vulnerability of Stuxnet.
Oh, yeah, we're going to enumerate the vulnerabilities.
Yeah, let's go through the third.
One was... bug in Explorer's link parser.
Okay.
This is the one that Stuxnet used primarily in its spreading.
Okay.
People stick USB keys into isolated networks, systems on isolated networks, and opens up Explorer. The second they view the file in Explorer, it basically the malware jumps from the file through that parsing vulnerability into Explorer, and Stuxnet begins to infect the machine.
These shortcut files have nothing to do with findlinks.
Yeah, these are dot link. These are Explorer shortcuts.
Yeah, these are shortcuts.
These are like when you right click and say create a shortcut on your desktop.
Right. Got it.
Totally.
And I demonstrate Stuxnet in my talk tomorrow, showing me navigating to a folder with that vulnerability, which obviously was patched as soon as Stuxnet was analyzed.
Cool.
A second one is a print spooler vulnerability. This is also was used for remote infection. So they would send a malformed request to the print spooler to jump from one machine to another. And then the other two were for local elevation and privilege. So those two were for spreading. There was one, a win32k.sys vulnerability that allowed it to, on Windows XP, it used this to gain admin rights if it was running a standard user. And then a task scheduler flaw, where if you create a scheduled task as administrator, it doesn't ACL the task file. It didn't ACL the task file properly. This affected Windows 7 and Windows Vista. So when Stuxnet got on the machine, it was running with standard user rights, would go, and because it could modify the task, we could create a task and then modify the ACL on it, or bypass protection that was supposed to be there, modify the task to run in the system account, and then execute the task. And that would give it admin rights. So those are the four.
And that kind of goes back to...
And Flame was using one of them. I think it was using the shell one. I can't remember which one.
Plus the cert bug.
Yeah.
So now this takes an awful awful lot of knowledge and experience to pull this off. So regardless of where, actually who did what, I mean, clearly these are scientists and expert programmers who have, must have some source code availability or have some insight into known bugs, maybe some. So I do think that you wrote the Stuxnet thing, man. So good luck with that.
Thanks for adding me on Channel 9.
I'm just joking. Okay. What's your hacker name, man? No. It's got to be Jedi. Jedi no. something.
No, it's Super Freak.
Super Freak?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's boring, man. So, but you are a Jedi hacker. Anyway, thanks for that information. We had a really interesting security panel today where we kind of dug into all of this stuff. Yeah.
But actually one of the things I thought you were going to talk about is, do you even know if you're infected? Unless there's a symptom, it's like cancer, right? Unless you see a symptom, you don't know. You look perfectly healthy, you're acting perfectly fine.
And then you die.
And there's something inside you, yeah.
So, yeah, when I said that no malware in the house, as far as I've never seen anything that shows any hint of it.
Can you write a sysinternal tool to fix the bootkit problem or to find it?
Yeah, but
how would you do that?
The antivirus researchers are doing that. It's part of their cleaning.
Do these guys use your tools?
Yeah, in fact, it's really cool. It's really cool because I see technical analysis of malware, including Flame. You know, the first company called Crisis in Hungary was one of the first to analyze Flame. Mm. So I go read the report, and of course they're showing VM Map and Process Explorer to show.
Excellent. Great. Well, we have about 4 minutes left. I'm assuming that timer is correct. Next up, we have Vice President Jason Zander, the Visual Studio CLR and DevDiv World. That's going to be awesome to talk to him about lots of things that they've been up to. But we still have 4 minutes of Mark. Any last questions? That's not a question, but... So, hey, thank you for your time.
All right.
For coming today.
Thanks, Charles.
I really
fun.
Appreciate it. It's always
Thanks.
Great to see you.
It was great to see you.
And,
next let me know time, what you think of Trojan Horse.
I will. I will let you know. I actually
okay. read
am reading that.
Okay.
I take Xanax and wine, man. Yeah. There's no reading for me. Yeah. All right.
That's a nice combo.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a great combo, man.